A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar.
That's the display department.
With a torch.
The lights probably gone.
So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 94. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are talking about The Flip Side of Dominic Hyde, and its sequel, Another Flip for Dominic. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello. Yes, we're time-travelling again here on British Invaders, and we're following the bewildered time-traveller Dominic Hyde as he heads back from the future to the chaos and confusion of 1980s London, which is the setup for the show we're talking about today, Brian.
Yes, it was actually a BBC production for the Play for Today series. It was a 90-minute show that ran in 1980 called The Flip Side of Dominic Hyde. And then its sequel, Another Flip for Dominic, ran just a couple years later in 1982. And both of them, the first one especially, featured a time travel adventure with a researcher from the future coming back to the past, or to the present, as it was at the time.
And it's quite a fun mix of science fiction and romance, and there's quite a humorous feel to it throughout, Brian. It's a fairly sort of entertaining mixture of all these elements, pushing it all together.
Yes, it's a very nice human story.
Yes, which sort of, as we'll discuss as we go along, uses the science fiction structure for that story. But we'll get into the story now in some more detail. So our character, Dominic Hyde, is what's called a Corro, which is short for correspondent, and he lives in 2130, and he uses a time-travelling flying saucer to go back and study the 1980s, and in particular 1980s London. And they refer to this travelling as going to the flip side, and we're told that the flip side is the era before the invention of time travel. And obviously there's a special interest in going back and researching this period. And as we find out very early on in the first of these plays, Dominic in particular is paying attention to London transport, of all things. So he's studying the transportation of London and public transport methods, which is rather amusing for anybody who's been in London.
That's right. And the future that we see is a very sterile place. People live in these sort of carefully climate-controlled houses, and everything is very carefully set and controlled. And very much that people have these sort of low stress lives in futuristic apartments that look like they have a somewhat Japanese kind of design to them, with holographic projections for entertainment. We also get suggestions that the environment may be heavily polluted and essentially unsafe for humans. So apart from maybe some very limited things, people are basically inside all the time.
Yeah, there's some hint that there was a disaster in the past or the future from 1980s London. They do mention some incident in 1999 very briefly, I think, Brian, but it's not clear as to whether that's what resulted in the pollution of the outside world.
Yes, they call it the Holocaust of 1999, and they mention that many people did not survive, but yeah, the details were not given.
So we have these Corros going back to observe the flip side. And again, we're sort of given some of the rules, or we pick them up from Dominic, that they're not supposed to interfere in the past. And certainly they're not supposed to land these flying saucer travel, time travel machines they have. They mustn't interfere in the past. And there's a story that's quoted a couple of times of a man called Cochrane. And this is given as the great example of how interfering in the past can cause all sorts of problems down the time stream. Because the man Cochrane, as we learn, accidentally killed a dog. And the dog would have raised the alarm for a fire. And some people then died in the burning building. And one of those people was a famous architect, and so his buildings were never built, and there were all sorts of implications. So that story is quoted as one of the reasons why Dominic Hyde shouldn't interfere in the past. of course, if he didn't land and didn't interfere, Brian, it would perhaps be a much shorter story. So he's got this flying saucer, which is usually invisible, and he's supposed to be observing from the air. But he has learnt that one of his ancestors may live in the part of London he's observing, and that obviously triggers some interest for him.
Yes, it does. And we, of course, also get this idea that flying saucer sightings were these people from the future who are observing our time, and they're not supposed to do it in such a way that the flying saucer is ever visible to people, but sometimes they mess up when they're leaving or when they're arriving, and it becomes visible. So that explains flying saucer sightings throughout time. So Dominic Hyde is searching for his great-great-grandfather, who was also called Dominic Hyde. So he breaks the rules, he gets some help from a technician who is a friend of his, and he lands his saucer in 1980 in London and starts walking around and seeing things, and particularly ends up in Portobello Road in London. So he's walking around in the marketplace and ends up falling in with a group of people who sort of adopt and take him on.
It's a colourful little crowd of people in the very colourful and exciting Portobello Road. And as you say, they sort of take him in, and yeah, you're pretty well right. They do seem to adopt Dominic and intrigued by his eccentricities.
Yeah, and what we get is the beginning of the culture shock story, and this is a big part of the flip side of Dominic Hyde, is the idea that the future culture and future sort of language, the variety of English that they're speaking, is very different from what they had in 1980. So there's a big culture shock for him, and everyone else thinks he's this sort of odd person they don't understand and think maybe he's from a strange religious order because he has a big funny hat. You end up with this sort of fish out of water story and the culture shock story, which is very important to this show.
What's your game?
Volleyball.
Come on, Gilby. Look, I won't tell anyone. What are you up to? Where do you come from? And don't say Rayner's Lane, because I shan't believe you.
What I say is unbelieving.
Try me.
I come from far away.
How far?
Quito. Ecuador.
Quito. That's how the natives pronounce it.
Live my life there. We don't drink coffee.
Are you in the church? Missionary?
I come on a mission.
Oh, to find Dominic Hyde for your great-aunt Mavis, who lives in Hemel Hempstead.
Some of that is true.
So we should get into discussing the characters. And we've mentioned the main one already, Brian, our hero.
Yes, Dominic Hyde was played by Peter Firth, known for Spooks and Double Deckers. And he's this bewildered time traveler trying to deal with everything from 1980. He doesn't know about 20th century money. There are all these things that he just isn't familiar with. He also speaks this sort of very abbreviated, futuristic kind of slang language, or, you know, variant of English, which makes it difficult for people to understand him and for him to understand other people. And this is something that they play with quite a bit in the show.
Yes, we've got another bit of future slang to decipher, which we've had in a couple of these time traveling shows or future shows. But it's, again, it's well done here, and it adds to that sort of air of eccentricity that Dominic Hyde has back in 1980s London. And as you say, we've got Peter Firth, who's very young here. I mean, he's well known now on BBC for playing the head of MI5 in Spooks. But it's quite a young Peter Firth taking the lead role in both of these plays. And he has a companion in 2130. He lives with a young woman called Ava, who was played by Pippa Gard. Again, and she turns up in both of the plays. She works for a travel agency, which is known as Tom Cook, which doesn't take too much to decipher which sort of British travel agency they're referring to. And she is interesting because she can't understand Dominic's obsession with the past and why he's so interested in 1980s London and so interested in finding his ancestor. So she's rather puzzled by it all. She's perhaps a more typical example of this, an inhabitant of this rather hygienic and sterile future.
Yes, and she's working with this travel agency, taking people on tours to the past to see the Olympics in the 1930s and so on. And of course, Tom Cook is a reference to Thomas Cook, the travel agency in the UK. But they build up quite an interesting and a little bit different relationship between the two of them in the future setting, which is quite nice. We also get a number of characters who are in the present, or in the 1980s setting. Most importantly, we get Jane, played by Carolyn Langrish. She is a young woman who Dominic meets in 1980, and it's pretty clear from the beginning that there is going to be a romance story, and of course there is. And it is also an interesting one because it's a relationship between two people who have very different context and understanding of the world from the two different times.
Yes, it does. It works well. And as you say, it's fairly obvious that there's going to be some sort of romantic interest between Dominic and Jane. And Carolyn Langrish looking quite stunning here in the early 80s. She went on to be in Lovejoy with Ian McShane, but I think this was one of her early TV roles. And they make a nice pairing.
Yes, the chemistry and the performance there is quite neat, as is the chemistry and performance in the future setting with Dominic and Ava. So the contrast between his two different relationships is quite neat.
And it's one of the features of this show and its sequel. We've also got Dominic's friend in the future, Alaric, who was played by Trevor Ray. And not only is he friend, as you've said already, Brian, he's the technician who controls Dominic's flips. And he has to go to some lengths to cover up for his friend as to what Dominic's actually doing in the past when it becomes obvious that Dominic is actually landing and interfering back in the 1980s. And he seems to control the technical side of things, certainly in the first part of the story.
Yes, that's right. We also have Caleb Line, who is a character in the future played by Patrick McGee, who we also discussed briefly with Beasts. Caleb is Dominic's boss. He is this rather sinister and somewhat creepy figure who warns Dominic about the dangers of the past and being spotted as a flying saucer and so on. He is very much someone who lays down the rules, but he also plays his hand close to his chest. You know, he is someone who you don't quite know what he's doing for most of the time. He is manipulating a lot of things, but you can never quite see exactly what he's doing.
Yes, he's an interestingly sinister figure. Patrick McGee always seems to play sinister figures. And as you say, he's got this controlling influence, which will be quite important as the story goes on. He's full of mystery. Quite a good performance again by Patrick McGee. And I think when he appeared in the sequel, I think that would be his last television performance before he died, Brian.
Oh, really? Interesting. There were also a number of characters in the 1980 time frame who made up this little peer group for Jane and Dominic and gave us a bunch of people who could be socializing together.
So turning to our production notes, the show was created by Alan Gibson, who was a Canadian-born TV director who worked mostly over here in the UK. And he was the one who had this idea when he was a child about flying saucers must represent time travelers from the future. This is this idea he came up with when he was a child, that they couldn't possibly come from other planets. They must represent time travelers.
Yeah, I think he was a teenager when he started playing with those ideas, but he apparently built up this whole little idea back in the 50s when he was quite young with the idea of the time traveler looking down from the flying saucers, and he had been sketching Dominic Hyde and so on. So he had sort of the fundamental ideas of this from quite early on.
So that's interesting, and it's certainly, you know, it's a very interesting idea that he'd come up with. And he spent several years working on this idea and submitting it to various TV companies for production until eventually it was picked up by the BBC Play for Today series, which was a, you know, as we've said before, I think a long-running BBC TV play slot and quite prestigious. It was very well regarded. And they eventually commissioned the flip side of Dominic Hyde.
And when they did that, Alan Gibson, who was primarily a director and not really a writer, looked for someone to do the main writing duties, and he found Jeremy Paul, who had written plays that Gibson had directed before. So the two of them, Jeremy Paul and Alan Gibson, co-wrote the script that would be used for this play.
And between them, they came up with the look and the feel of 2130. They gave it this very sleek, hygienic, sealed appearance. Dominic travels to work in a bullet train that travels on the London Underground. We've mentioned they have slightly unusual futuristic costumes, which will cause some humour when Dominic travels back in his. We see other bits of their life. We see them making instant food from some form of tablet, and we see them watching holographic television in their apartment. They're watching musicians play in a sort of holographic projection, which will lead to quite a neat joke back in the 80s.
Yes, the look and the feel and the sound of the future that they put together for this was quite neat. And, you know, they had this very sort of spare, hygienic kind of look to things. They also had the type of dialogue that was very sort of short and clipped and used quite unusual phrasing in it. And that was something that they put some effort into, and it worked quite well. It was something that really added to this, and they used a lot. And for entertainment, they went to this idea of there being these holograms of string musicians playing Beatles music. So you had, you know, string quartets and a lute in one case, almost invariably playing the music of the Beatles. So that was quite cute. And production was in 1980, and it was filmed in and around London and also on the Isle of Wight. Alan Gibson, who had come up with this idea originally, directed it himself, and their main special effect for this was the flying saucer itself, which they suspended from a 200-foot crane. There were some other visual effects here and there, but that was the big deal, was the actual flying saucer that Dominic traveled in.
Yes, and it works pretty well. As you say, there were a few other visual effects. I guess the holographic musicians themselves and so on. And interestingly, apparently Peter Ragg, who worked on the visual effects for this, had sort of cut his teeth doing visual effects for Thunderbirds, which we've discussed before. And after this show, he would go on to do visual effects on both Threads and also for Red Dwarf. So two other shows that we've discussed with particularly impressive visual effects that he sort of tested out a few of his ideas here in Dominic Hyde, I guess, Brian.
That's interesting.
We've got plenty of music in this. We've got a rather melancholy theme song called You Better Believe It, Babe, which was provided by a band called Meal Ticket and features throughout both the play, and it's also used as a theme tune for the sequel as well. And as you've said, Brian, there's other bits of music popping up throughout the show.
Yes, you had certainly the Beatles music on the string instruments in the future was throughout it. You also had a bit of Bob Marley popping up there, a bit of the Police, things like this that were in the contemporary 1980 setting, where you had, you know, people in pubs and going to parties and dances and things. So they had some pop music popping up in there, and as background music in scenes with no dialogue, they would use it as well. So there definitely was some pop music in there, and that was kind of fun.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, and this play for today, as we said, was broadcast on BBC One on the 9th of December in 1980.
Which, sadly, was just hours after the news had broken about John Lennon's death, I believe, Brian. And the play for today actually, you know, which featured Lennon and McCartney music in it, actually had to start late because I believe the BBC News broadcast overran that night as they discussed John Lennon's death.
That's certainly an odd coincidence that the show that was on at the time had this rather nice tribute to the Beatles music in it. So kind of interesting.
Yes. It was interesting and sort of strange little coincidence, as you say.
Absolutely.
Are there somewhere islands over the horizon, hidden by the morning mist, forever out of reach? Are there somewhere islands?
So I think that brings us to the end of the first half of our discussion about the Dominic Hyde shows. So next time, we will talk more about the story of The Flip Side of Dominic Hyde, and we will get a little more into the sequel, Another Flip for Dominic.
And as ever, we'll discuss the availability of this show and get to our reviews and recommendations. So quite a bit to get through in our second episode.
Yes, we definitely have more to talk about on this one. So you can reach us at BritishInvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at www.BritishInvaders.com. We have a Facebook group, so if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you will find us there. So thank you for listening. This is Brian from Canada, signing off.
And yes, thank you very much, and we'll see you next time. Until then, this is Eamon in England, saying goodbye.